Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast, your source for policy rants and raves, and former employees joining the show from Tech Freedom, your Washington, D.C. advocate for the freedom to tinker and innovate. I'm Evan Schwartzschreiber, your host. On today's show, a lifeline for telephone service, a lifeline for cellular service, and now a lifeline for broadband service. Currently, U.S. taxpayers subsidize landline and wireless telephone service for low-income users who meet certain criteria. You may have heard this program referred to derisively by skeptics as the Obama phone program, but it certainly predates President Obama. Is this an effective way of getting people connected to communication services? Should this program be expanded to cover broadband? Joining me to discuss this is Will Reinhart, Director of Technology and Innovation Policy at American Action Forum, a policy and research institute. Will, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Evan. And I look forward to today's conversation.
Well, Will, you used to work at Tech Freedom, and then you left. Was it for more money and a better title, or did you just get fed up with Barron?
I'm going to hold back on that question. I'm not going to say one way or the other.
I think that's all the answer that our listeners need on that one. But let's get into the issue. So what is the Lifeline program, Will, and how did it come about?
Yeah, so the Lifeline program is a program that helps to subsidize communication needs for low-income families, and it's actually been around for a while. It started in the 1980s under the Reagan administration, and the idea was to have some sort of program that provided lifeline connection for individuals that needed a connection to communication services. So it really, it's existed for quite some time, and I don't really know that we have a very good idea of why it's existed for such a good time, for such the long time that it has.
Well, so how has the program changed over time? I mean, it started in the 1980s with basic telephone service. What did it look like then? What does it look like today?
Yeah, back in the day, it was mainly applied to telephone service. This is your fixed telephone. And over the years, it's slowly expanded out to include wireless services or your cellular voice. And then recently, it also expanded out to include those cellular service providers who actually don't have fixed communications facilities, as they're called. So it's expanded out over the years, mainly to include wireless, but also further to include all these other ancillary service providers.
So before we get into the issue of whether this program should be expanded to cover a new service like broadband, let's talk about how it's doing to date. Is this program effective in its current form, where it provides subsidies to both wireless service and wireline telephone service?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. And to be completely honest, I don't think that we have any good sense one way or the other if it is effective. The FCC hasn't done the kind of studies that it needs to do on this. And in fact, the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, has specifically said that that the FCC needs to conduct these programs, and they haven't. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, and the GAO seems to really think it's ineffective. A study they did showed that only 1 in 8 people who are enrolled in a Lifeline service did so due to the program. So the other 7 out of 8 would have just gotten the service anyway, so they're getting a subsidy they don't need. If you parse out landline telephone service and just look at wireless, it's even more striking. Only 1 in 20 people who subscribe to prepaid wireless service through Lifeline did so due to the subsidy. Now, listeners might be asking themselves, how is that possible? How is it that we have a program where 7 out of 8 people don't need it, or 19 out of 20 people don't need it? Well, it's less surprising when you realize that 34% of Americans right now are eligible for subsidies. So a third of our population is eligible for the subsidy. They don't necessarily take advantage. So the GAO seems to think it's ineffective. Has the FCC done anything with this information?
No, the FCC has. It doesn't look like they're going to. The FCC, and I think we're going to talk about this a little bit here, a little bit later in the program. But the FCC is looking to expand out and reform the program, and expand out the program specifically for broadband, and also kind of change around, tinker around with some of the program requirements. But what's been pretty clear is they have never really done the kind of work that you would assume that a government agency would do in order to just make an effective program. So almost every single other agency has to do cost-benefit analyses. They have to do, you know, they have to do program evaluations. They have economists working in the background to look at the how effective their programs and how effective their rules are. The FCC really is one of the only agencies, really only the major agency that exists out there that doesn't have this kind of knowledge background. That's actually very, very worrying to me. And it shows itself in exactly this program. In that the FCC hasn't done the kind of research and the kind of analysis, the kind of hardcore quantitative econometric analysis that you would actually need to do in order to figure out if it's good for people or if it's harmful, which it might actually be.
Yeah, I mean, it's counterintuitive to think that a program that subsidizes communication services for low-income people could be harmful to consumers, but it really could be. And we'll talk about that a little later, but what makes the FCC so special that it doesn't do cost-benefit analysis? You suggest that most agencies, you know, when they're weighing a regulatory action, they sit down and they think about, on balance, is this going to help consumers or hurt them? Why, in your view, is the FCC specifically avoiding this type of analysis, not just in Lifeline, but in other areas?
Well, that would also, well, you know, as one person said, as one lawyer interestingly said about econometric analysis, it's, you know, this is at the FTC. He noted that this, you know, the FTC's Bureau of Economic Analysis is often where rules go to die. And that's exactly the case, is that when you actually put programs under analysis and the kind of policy analysis that we do and we strive for, that you see, you pull open the hood and you see actually what's going on, and you try to figure out if these things are actually helpful to individuals. Why the FCC hasn't done it for this program is actually kind of striking, and I don't know if there's any great answers for that. But even more, I think that the FCC, I know that the FCC really doesn't have the kind of institutional structure to force it to do this kind of analysis, which is something, it's a reform that I've been suggesting for quite some time. Particularly to reform the FCC such that it has more of the empirical analysis baked into the very, very core of the institution.
Yeah, if regulations can't stand up when you weigh the costs and benefits, and maybe the agencies like the FCC are afraid to do it because they know that it's going to, like the GAO suggested, that the findings not going to be favorable to a regulatory agenda.
Exactly,
which, yeah. Which might be driven more by politics than any sort of concern for consumers or any sort of intent to create a better marketplace or things like that. It's very possible. We talked about on the show before that regulatory agencies that are supposed to be independent but are necessarily by their nature made up of three commissioners from the president's party and two from the minority party, politics is going to make its way into those bodies, however you slice it. It's not supposed to, but it happens. And this really begs the question, should the FCC be expanding this program to cover broadband when it hasn't done the analysis it needs to do to justify the current program for telephone and wireless?
I'm very hesitant to do that. I'm very hesitant to expand out the program for broadband, primarily because the analysis has not been done. And it worries me that we're going down a path that essentially says, okay, we have this new expanded program to help individuals, which, I mean, there are individuals that need to be helped. There are households that do need some kind of, you know, that often need some type of assistance. But the question is, how do you do that effectively? And without understanding even what the FCC had done in the past with wireless programs, with fixed wireline. I mean, they haven't even really looked at fixed wireline, let alone wireless services. So the fact that the agency hasn't done either of those kinds of analysis on their previous programs, it worries me that what the path that they're going down now is actually not going to be effective for the very people it's supposed to help.
And certainly the two minority commissioners on the FCC, Commissioner Ajit Pai and Commissioner Mike O'Reilly, they are both Republicans. They have long griped about waste, fraud, and abuse in the current program before it even goes to broadband. They're worried about the current program. And you have things like double enrollment, two people within the same household getting connections, people using dead people's social security numbers to enroll in the program. I mean, there's a lot of problems that haven't been fixed, and those commissioners would argue you shouldn't be talking about expanding a broken program before it's been fixed. So there's the issues of whether it's even effective at doing what it's supposed to do, which is to bridge the digital divide, and then there's the issues of fraud. So But the FCC is charging ahead, and they are making some reforms to the program. They're responding to some of the criticism. They're not completely ignoring them. But you pointed out that back in 2008, the FCC made changes to Lifeline. Again in 2012, they're making changes again soon. What are these changes that the FCC's been doing, and how are today's changes different from those that happened 10, 5 years ago?
Yeah, so I mean, some of the things that they plan to do very shortly, well, in addition to actually having Lifeline apply to broadband, they are looking to change the program a little bit and ensure that some of the reforms that have been suggested for a number of years actually do pass through. So one of the things that's at least been suggested, and it seems that they're probably going to do, is now determine eligibility for the program through a third-party provider. In the past, you had companies, specifically, you know, phone companies of all various, you know, sizes, both large and small, determine who is eligible for the programs. And this was actually, as you know, as Commissioner Ajit Pai actually had mentioned, this was probably the reason why the program expanded out pretty dramatically after 2008. Now, admittedly, 2008 was obviously the beginning of the economic downturn, but there was a pretty clear expansion after 2008 with new individuals.
And the problem here is that when a company is in charge of deciding who's eligible, they don't necessarily have a good incentive to keep the eligibility requirements rigid, because if they explain how the program works a little bit, because that might illustrate why it's a problem for a telephone company to be the one deciding who's eligible, because they want more people in the program theoretically, because they're getting a discount. So how does it work exactly? You've got multiple stakeholders. You've got the FCC, you've got the American taxpayer, you've got Lifeline recipients, and then you've got companies providing the service. How does that all work?
Yeah, this is actually kind of a convoluted system, and this is why, again, I think that, you know, an evaluation process is important in this. So the way that it works currently is that you have each individual who pays, you know, who has a cellular service or a long distance service, technically speaking. Those individuals pay a certain fee, and that's reassessed every quarter. That fee then goes into a big pot. It's called the USF fund. That USF fund then pays out to four different major programs within the Universal Service Fund. Lifeline is among the largest. I think it is the largest of the four programs, the four major programs. And as has happened in the past, Lifeline is actually the only one that did not have a budget. It was not capped. So there was a natural incentive for those individuals who would then get paid out. Well, let me step back for a second. So you had this large pot of money that the Lifeline money was then used to pay back companies to expand out and give service to individuals who are eligible for that service. So it's a convoluted way of allowing individuals who are, you know, who are needy to actually get communication service. Now, the ultimate question, of course, is the eligibility itself the proper way? Is the way that it was done in the past was a, you know, a company would essentially they would essentially sign up individuals, and there was really no verification if those individuals really should have been on the program to begin with. This is one of the reforms that seems to be going through, which I'm actually very happy about, and I think that the FCC has done a very positive thing with ensuring that there's a third party that actually determines eligibility.
Yeah, the basic problem being that if you can't verify eligibility, companies are just going to go signing people up all the time.
Bingo, exactly.
And because there's no budget for the program in the past, it's limitless. So there's no disincentive for companies to sign up too many people, because the more people that get signed up, they'll just increase the budget for the program. So I know that's one of the big gripes that you've seen in dissents from the Republican commissioners, that there's no budget and the eligibility requirements are decided by people who are too close to the issue. They have too much of an economic incentive to sign people up. Two basic problems right there. Are the new reforms going to address that?
Well, to step back just a second also, I think that the one thing that really hasn't been talked about is exactly what problem Lifeline is trying to solve. So the assumption is that individuals within this program are, one, either not connected to whatever communication service it may be, if it's wireless or wired telephone, and so we need to get them on to these communication services. Now, that's a bit of a different problem, getting people connected who aren't connected, as compared to keeping people connected who are currently connected but face some sort of financial pressure. Right. And both of those are actually what the program aims to do at the core, but they've never really defined, again, and I think this goes back to what I keep on going back to, which is evaluation, which is that, you know, we really don't know what the problem that Lifeline is actually trying to solve. And I think that's a core thing that really, that even with some of the reforms that have been proposed, I think that's actually the core issue that has not been resolved.
Yeah, if the problem is that people can't afford services, that's the problem, and that's why it's called a Lifeline. The GAO study suggests that that's not the problem, because the vast majority of them are getting the subsidy, but they didn't necessarily need it. And then you had another striking statistic, something like only 2 million, or when it comes to broadband, so the GAO report dealt with people who are getting the subsidy for cell service or landline service. If you are looking to expand the program to broadband, as the FCC is doing, let's look at who can afford broadband. You suggested that only 2 million people in the United States don't have broadband because they can't afford it. The rest just don't want it?
Yeah, so a very large percentage of individuals who do not have broadband services, not because they can't afford internet service, but primarily because they don't see it as a relevant feature of their life, or they find it actually difficult to use. Two-thirds of individuals actually who are not connected to the internet in any way aren't connected because of these relevancy and usability issues. Only 6% of all people who are not connected to the internet are not connected primarily because of the price of the internet service. That means that, I did a little bit of calculation, at the end of the day, it looks that all total, the amount of individuals who actually would use Lifeline, the broadband Lifeline, the expanded broadband portion of Lifeline, to actually get onto the program, there would only be about 2 million people. But as the budget has allocated, the entire budget means that about 20 million people could probably get on Lifeline and stay on Lifeline.
So you've got a similar situation then to the telephone and the wireless problem, where the vast majority of the people getting the subsidy don't need it. Only a fraction of them actually do need it. And the program is not structured in a way to target those who need it. Instead, it's giving out gifts to people who don't. And one of the biggest problems with this program is that it is arguably the most regressive tax in the United States. And I use the word tax, I should really use the word fee, because the only difference between a tax and a fee when we're talking about the government is who's imposing it on you. So a tax, by its nature, must go through Congress. Congress is not imposing the fees that you see on your phone bill, which go to Lifeline. That is the FCC. So you're still paying money, but the difference is just who's charging you. And the FCC charges fees, Congress charges taxes. So those fees are the same regardless of your income if you're not eligible for Lifeline. So I'm a rich guy, I make millions of dollars, I pay a certain percent. I'm barely above the eligibility threshold for Lifeline, I'm paying the same. So it's not like the income tax, which goes up as you make more money, it's progressive. This tax is regressive. Mm-hmm. And arguably the people who are hurt most by this program are those who are just above the eligibility threshold, where the fees do hurt them, but they can't be eligible for the program.
Exactly. And this is exactly what you would want to actually figure out through an evaluation process. This kind of work has been done. There's actually a bit of variability in it, and there's some kind of interesting research on this. But at the end of the day, really, we still don't have a very good sense of how much, not just USF fees and Lifeline, just generally speaking, but taxes writ large affect individuals' propensity to consume. I mean, when you look at individuals and how much they're paying for wireless services, wireless taxes actually tend to be among the most discriminatory taxes in the United States. In many cities, especially where I know you're from and where I'm from, the taxes can be over 20%.
Yeah, Chicago and New York.
Yeah, yeah. Chicago and New York. And so for individuals who don't have the economic wherewithal and the means to spend a lot of money on their communication services, the amount that taxes actually take out of their budget is fairly significant. What that means, practically speaking, is that individuals might actually be forced off of communication services primarily because of the expense of the taxes taken altogether.
So the irony is that a program which is designed to bridge the digital divide and get more people on communication services could actually be kicking off those people who the only difference between subscribing to broadband and not subscribing to broadband is the fee, because they're funds are that limited that they can't be having their cake and eating it too. They have to decide, and they might just decide, you know what, I've been going without broadband until now. Why am I going to sign up now, right when the fee kicks in? And let's just, to wrap up, let's talk about timeline here. So we've got, last week the FCC released a fact sheet kind of outlining what it's going to do to extend the program to broadband. They vote on it March 31st. Obviously, it's you know, we can predict that they're going to vote 3-2 in favor of extending the program. The three Democrats will vote yes. The two Republicans will vote no. And then we will see how that shakes out. But I like to ask listeners this question, or guests this question. Will Reinhart, if you were FCC commissioner and you could do whatever you wanted on this issue, what would you do?
What would I do on this issue? I mean, as I keep on going back, I would actually force the commission to evaluate the program in the way that it should be evaluated. And one thing that, as we close, I want you to think about is that there's this really interesting connection between individuals, and not interesting, but it's just is a connection, that people who are older tend to make less money just because, again, they're retiring, etc. But that these individuals who are older also tend not to be connected to the internet. And so you have this very interesting confluence for this group of people who is over 65, who tends not to be connected to the internet, who also tends to not have the income, at least in the statistics that you would assume. And so this is actually something that I have been working on. I've done some research that tries to look at this specifically. The point is that a actual robust study of this topic would look at not just the effects of income, but also look at the effects of income with regards to age. And some of the stuff that I've done actually shows that the real determining factor here isn't actually income. The real determining factor is actually age, and that older individuals just aren't connected to the internet. How we reach them is a really big question, and obviously we should do something about it. Well, maybe we don't know how to do anything about it. And that's, I guess, that goes back to evaluating the process and evaluating the program.
Yeah, you got to find out, is it because people don't want to use the internet? Maybe that's not such the national crisis that the FCC makes it out to be. But we'll certainly be tracking this issue on the podcast. That's it for today's show. My guest has been Will Reinhard, Director of Technology and Innovation Policy at the American Action Forum, a policy and research institute. Will has managed to exceed despite not working for Tech Freedom anymore, incredibly. So Will, thank you for gracing us with your presence on the show.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Will's got a blog out today, What's Missing for the Lifeline Reforms. You can check that out. We link to it in the show notes. Follow us on Twitter at Tech Freedom or on Facebook.com/Tech Freedom. Find this podcast in the iTunes store or on your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review. It will help us and it will help others find the show. Thank you for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.